Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Over the Cap podcast. It's May 28th, 2021, and this is Jason Fitzgerald. You can find me on Twitter at Jason_OTC, or of course at overthecap.com. As always, I am here with our trusted bunny, Nelly. Nelly, you got anything? Nope, didn't think so. Maybe my daughter will stop in for old time's sake, and maybe she'll say hello. She was down here a little bit before. I thought she was going to stick around for a little bit and jump on the podcast, but not as of right now. And then my son actually fell asleep on the couch, which means I got to carry him upstairs. That's going to be a pain. So I'm definitely not looking forward to that. So as soon as I get done, I think that is next on my list of things to do. And that's a little bit of a hike. He's pretty big for, I guess, for 6 years old. So carrying him up the stairs is always a bit of a pain. Apologize in advance if there's some noise in the background here. We're having some pretty heavy rains in New Jersey, and it looks like our one little window here just sprouted a small leak that I thought I had taken care of last year, and it hadn't leaked at all, but now it looks like it's back in one location. So that's just going to have to be what it is tonight, and I'll get that fixed up tomorrow. It's not much coming in, but there's a little bit coming in, and I can hear it running right behind where we have this. So most of the noise is coming from the outside, but there's a little bit of a drip that's coming through here that I'm sure is probably going to get picked up based on where I have everything set up. So just a quick apology in advance for that. We've got our Michelob Ultra tonight. We're still going with our low-calorie, low-carb beer. They're almost like drinking nothing, but at least it gives a little something to sip on during the podcast here. I'm also very excited to officially be maskless now in New Jersey. Went to the gym this morning and found out that they were no longer going to require masks if you were vaccinated. And I am pretty sure, based on the amount of people that were wearing masks at the gym, it didn't really make a difference. I think just everybody took them off. And it was different. You know, it had been so long since I had really worked out with without the mask. It was a little bit of a weird feeling. But, you know, glad that all the states are going with the no mask stuff now. And, you know, it sounds like we'll have a pretty relatively normal summer, and then hopefully everything is good from here on out. So tonight we'll do a little bit more on the Falcons, just because I did get a lot of comments on that. So rather than going over them individually, it'll just be the general stuff. Most of the stuff that I'll talk about is, you know, really just how they got there. I mean, that was really the general question is questions about the general manager and how things got where they got right now with in regards to their salary cap and the roster and everything else. I'll talk a little bit about the Hunter situation in Minnesota. That popped up at least on my timeline, and I guess a little bit in the news over the last couple days. He was unhappy with his contract last year. He's still unhappy. So we'll just touch on a couple things with that. I'll talk a little bit about this article that I wrote this week, just looking at draft benefits and free agency. Just a quick overview. I got a couple interesting comments from that league side. And, I guess just real quick, I'll start with this. The NFL salary cap, I forgot all about this. They actually set a ceiling on the salary cap. So we'll talk about that first, then I'll talk about the Falcons. So they actually capped the cap next year at $208.2 million. It's kind of a strange move. I think that pretty much tells you that the cap next year will be $208.2 million. So we've updated all the numbers on the website to reflect a salary cap of $208.2. As far as I know, the league has never done this before. Always before, there's been a floor for a couple of certain periods. Obviously this year there was a floor that was put in place. So what changed here? And I think what changed here is when the league sets your salary cap for a given year, part of setting the salary cap for 2021 is you basically have your estimates of your revenues for the year. And then they were backing out all the money that they lost in 2020, a portion of it. You know, they'd agreed to attribute that number to a couple of different seasons. Well, when they made these estimates, those estimates were made back, usually I think they're supposed to be made in January or February. I think this year they pushed everything just based on when the salary cap was announced. I think it was pretty much pushed until March. And at the time, the pandemic was still a thing. You know, the teams were anticipating 70% capacity, I think, for their stadiums league-wide, knowing that certain teams like the Cowboys were probably going to have full attendance, whereas some of the other teams, they probably would have figured that, you know, the Jets, you know, the teams in New York, the Jets, Giants, the Bills, yes, I know the two are in New Jersey, the California teams probably were going to be much lower than that, you know, maybe 50% capacity, 40%, something like that. And now it seems pretty clear that everything will be 100% capacity unless something bizarre happens. So I think what happened is that their numbers were going to be way off this year, and it was going to lead to a spike in the cap that I think the NFL did not want. Spikes in the cap are difficult for the league. It's something that they have fought against since 2006, screwed them over when the cap jumped from, like, I don't remember, 68 to 86 million, maybe. It was like a $20 million jump. It was a crazy jump, and it completely changed the landscape for a lot of salaries around the league. And what the league did in 2011 was that they put an end to that. So the system they put in place has very, very, very steady growth of about 5-6% a year. That's why every season, what did we see? $10 million a year, the cap would rise, you know, give or take probably $1 million. So based on if there was no pandemic, where would we expect the salary cap to have been this year? And probably the salary cap would have been right around $210 million, which meant next year it would probably be around $220 million. So my guess is if the NFL actually saw the real numbers come in, and they're working on a cap now of 198 plus you know, plus whatever offsets they still have to pay back on the cap, my guess is you were probably looking at a massive spike, because what would have happened is if you're, again, working on your regular things, we would have had 210 this year. In 2010, so you would have probably had about 220 to 225 for 2022. So that would have been your baseline, would have been 225. Now you would have added all this excess, because we're at 188 or 182, and you would have been up at you know, a 210 level. So that would have been a $30 million that you would have had to add on top of that. So, you know, that would have pushed your numbers to 252. Give or take again a little bit. And then you would take off what you owed to the Players Association, or what the Players Association owed you. Let's say it's an extra $20 million, $25 million. You know, that still probably would have put you in the 230s, 225, 230. It's too big of a jump for the NFL. That's too big of a jump. So I think this shows you how much they're willing to let the cap go for a year. And, you know, it's right around that $15 million. I think this should give us a very good indication of what will happen when the new television deals kick in a sense that this is maybe what we're going to be looking at, you know, 14% growth, that's probably the max we'll see. But instead of maybe 6% growth, maybe we're going to see something closer to 10% growth when the numbers come in. But I think this was done to make sure that there was not this giant leap in contracts. That there was a leap in required spending. And I think what they're going to do now by setting this floor, they will pay back everything. The Players Association will get to pay back everything. A lot of that's going to offset now. And what they'll probably do is the stuff that the NFLPA kind of put on hold, benefits that were supposed to be paid out 3-4 years from now, I believe. My guess is they're going to get that all restored right away. So I think everyone is going to come back now, and you're basically going to say, okay, 2020 is now set. We're good to go. And I think from there, they'll be able to move forward, and they'll be able to have those steady cap numbers that probably coincide more with the actual increased revenue that's going to be coming in from the television contracts in 2023. So 2023 is very clearly going to be the year that we look at for the big jump in the salary cap. And we've talked about that before, but that gives teams a lot of time to plan for that, you know, and it puts it at a reasonable level for spending as well, because the spending bucket is 2021, 2022, 2023. Most teams are going to be way over the cap in terms of cash spending this year because we haven't seen teams do that bloodletting of veterans. So, you know, I think this keeps the rosters consistent and will let them maintain some type of normalcy when it comes to negotiating contracts and free agency and negotiating extensions in the next couple of, the next 6 to 9 months. So now just running back to the Falcons here. So, you know, the question came up a lot about, you know, how bad was Dimitroff? Like, just how awful was he to leave the Falcons in this kind of position? And he had a good run. You know, I think that the fact that he had a good run has been kind of completely lost. You know, it talked about that a little bit last week, you know, that the salary cap guy who used to be in charge of their football ops side has really gotten a lot of heat with people talking about the issues they have. Said, you know, it's not necessarily their fault. You know, it just kind of is what it is, you know, the way that they ran through it. But, you know, the thing is, I think when I started to think about this, when I started to think about the questions that I got a lot about this, it was just kind of like, you know, I think when you look at general managers in the NFL, you probably need to put them in some type of like bucket, some type of bins or something like that. You know, how would you group them? And there's going to be variations on all of it. But I think when you look at the teams around the league, you know, I think you can find a couple different kind of strategies. I mean, there are certain teams where the general managers, I think, are very calculated. They will occasionally take risk. They will, for the most part, plan to have rosters that are talent in, talent out. Which I think is one of the most important things in the NFL. You always have to have your eye on the next season, the next 2 years. You can't just have your eye on the present. You shouldn't just have your eye on 2021. You need to have your eye on 2022 because you need to have the confidence that you can let contributors leave the team that you think are going to be too expensive to maintain. You have to have the confidence that you can replace them via free agency with younger players who maybe won't cost as much. And through the draft, you know, you have to have an idea of how you're going to do this. And I think by strategically attacking free agency year after year versus the all in one season approach, teams do that. You know, Baltimore fits into that category. I think the Patriots before this year certainly fit into that category. You know, I think there's a couple of teams that do. You know, Buffalo, I think at this point fits into that category. So I think that there are number ones that kind of fall into that range. Then you have teams that are just kind of content. You know, Minnesota, I think at this point is a team, and they do some silly stuff every now and then, like the Ngakoue thing, and where you just kind of lose sight of, do they know where they're at? But I think you find these teams that occasionally are just content. You know, I think Seattle is kind of content with what they have, with what they do. You know, those are the teams that a lot of times you will probably see not pull as many levers as you would hope in free agency. Might do some things in the draft that make you bang your head. Pittsburgh probably falls into that category a little bit. You know, that's kind of what those teams do. Then you have teams that are just haphazard, you know, teams that just have no clue. They just can't get a system in place. Nothing makes sense. The Jets had two general managers like that, and John Idzik and Mike Maccagnan, especially in Mike Maccagnan. It's like you go to the left one day, now you're going to the right the next day, then you're going up, then you're going down. You just can't make any sense of it. You know, the teams that have these general managers that just bounce in, bounce out, you know, that those are the worst of the worst, right? Yeah, those are the teams right now that are like the Houston Texans. I think they're that way. Yeah, the Bengals, they follow their own path, so I wouldn't put them in that category. You know, the Lions were certainly like that. The Jets had been like that before Joe Douglas. I don't know if I'd put the Panthers. I don't think the Panthers you'd put like that. Yeah, but there's a couple of teams I think you would look at that way as well, with the way that they approach stuff. You know, and then I think one of the other categories is risk takers. And your risk takers can be extremely successful, but they can also be really devastating for an organization. And I think that that's really where he kind of fits in. You know, he was someone who, not unlike a Howie Roseman, Mike Tannenbaum. He's someone that took risks, took a risk with the salary cap. Like, rather than chance losing players, you know, it's not a player in, player out. It's player in, don't have player out. You know, screw the salary cap. You know, we'll deal with it. It's a year by year thing. We'll deal with it. Even though eventually there's a year comes where you really can't deal with it. And they have 2 years of pain probably coming up. It makes a lot of moves in the draft. You know, a lot of trade ups. And when you trade up and you get Julio Jones, when you trade up and you get Darrell Revis, it is all high fives. It is all hugs. It is all praise. And then you have a team, you know, that hits that top point where they get to the Super Bowl, almost win the Super Bowl. All right. Almost win it. Should have won it. And it's like everything is, you're golden. You are golden. And then the risks that you're taking, they don't pay off anymore. And why is that? Well, that's just normal. You know, if you're expecting every single time, you know, to pull an ace out of a deck, you know, it can only happen so many times, right? And then a whole bunch of times it's not going to work out for you. And I think the reason where I say it can be devastating is you get a lot of leeway when you come in and you're successful with those strategies right off the bat. You know, again, you're the golden child, right? You can't do anything wrong. And they have faith in you to fix it. When things start to go bad, there is faith in you to fix the organization because you did it once before. But this time around, you probably have less resources to do it with. Why? Well, your salary cap could be a problem. You might not have as many draft picks because of some of the stuff you've done. Your other draft picks, you don't have any other players that are, you know, kind of on the team that are coming into their primes. You have players going out of their primes. So even your good players are probably not going to be great anymore. So it becomes kind of like a hard thing. And if you're a risk taker, you know, if you're a gambler, right, that's really hard because now you're being told we need to put handcuffs on you. And it's like, you can't survive that way, right? That's not the way that you built your teams. That's not the way that you are. You know, it's like, I used to like to play cards. Before I got married, I used to play cards a lot with my friends. I used to go to Atlantic City a lot and play. You know, nothing crazy. You know, most of the time it would be playing like, you know, 1-2 no limit or I guess 2-4 at the time. I think now most is 2-5. I don't go anymore. But, you know, I used to go, and I used to like to go to racetrack a lot too when I was younger. And, you know, you would see a lot of people spending sometimes a lot of money. And, you know, I would go play cards, and it was like, okay, you go with a couple $100s, you make a night out of it. You know, you go with enough to let you play usually for a while. You get some free drinks. If you get a good table, usually you can have a lot of fun. Sometimes you get a lousy table where people don't want to interact or do anything like that. But sometimes you get a pretty good table where, you know, people just have a good time with it and get a couple drinks and whatnot. But I remember one time playing, and, you know, I think it was at Caesars. I used to play at Showboat a lot when that still existed, but I think this was at Caesars. I don't think it was at the Trop. So I think it was Caesars. Definitely wasn't Showboat. Yeah, and I remember playing, and I don't know what my buy-in was, probably like $300 or something like that. Yeah, maybe a little bit more. You know, some guy comes in, you know, sits down at the table, and, you know, he buys in for $500, something like that. You know, it was a pretty good amount of money. And starts playing. And I'm like, what is this guy doing? Like, I can't figure out. Like, the first game we play, I think I had a pair of kings and I caught a third. And the other stuff that's on there, it's like, okay, there's no way anyone is playing for straight. I'm like, all right, you know, maybe somebody will pay a couple bucks here and I'll make a couple dollars. Keeps going. What is this guy doing? Okay. Once more, I'm looking at the cards. I'm like, what's he playing for? You know, did maybe he had the other king. Maybe he's playing on a pair of kings. I'm like, I have no idea what he's playing for. I can't come up with anything logical at that point that you would probably be staying in. He was staying in. I don't remember what it was. He was going for like a some wacky straight where he had a pretty big split. It, you know, would have been like a you know, like a 6 and a 10 maybe he had. You know, it was something crazy. And then it was like, all right, you know, maybe he just wanted to do it that way. And then he's playing every hand like this. And he blew through all his money pretty damn quick. You know, it didn't last him very long. Next thing you know, he's pulling out his wallet and he's, you know, he's angry. He's losing the money. He's pulling out his wallet and it's like $20 more. I need 20 more in. It's like, what are you doing? And then it's like, he loses that. And he's like, 20 more. It's like, that's all he had. It's like, I swear to God, he went through like his paycheck for the week or something in 30 minutes. I felt bad for the guy, but and who knows, maybe he had a lot of money and was just getting aggravated because just angry wasn't winning. But he was just going after anything that had a remote possibility he was going after. And it's like, sometimes I think if you gamble a lot, that's just what you do. You're chasing. You're constantly, when you lose, you get in a panic and you start to chase. You know, if you play, you know, like even if you just bet on sports, you lose every week. Finally, one week, it's just like, all right, I'm just putting it all in on this, you know, or fantasy sports or whatever it is. You know, you kind of lose track sometimes of what you have and you just go. And I think for some of the GMs, when you fall into these trouble periods, I think it's almost like having a gambler that needs to gamble on like 8 sports. You know, you want to gamble on everything. And now you're putting them in a box and saying, look, you can only gamble on one. And you're just trying to punch your way out of the box so you can gamble on like 8 different things. And you can't do it. You know, and you open that, or you open that wallet, and instead of having $500, you've only got 20. Now it's like, all right, I need this $20 to work for me. This 20 has got to turn into $600. And you do something stupid. And I think that's what happened in Atlanta. You know, and that's what happens, I think, with a lot of these teams. You know, with Atlanta, you know, again, all the cachet that's been built up over the years, you can deal with duds like a McKinley. You can deal with a dud like a Golston. You know, because you've got these other ones that are great, and you've kind of hidden some of these failures. Now you just need to do something. And the only thing you know how to do is to do risky stuff. You know, there's not a patience level. Maybe you feel there's not a patience level from your ownership or fan base or anything else. But that's what leads to sending a second round pick for Hayden Hurst. It's what leads to signing a player like a Dante Fowler. It's what leads to doubling and tripling down on all the contracts that the Atlanta Falcons did. You know, it's very much the same thing that, you know, like I said with the Jets, you know, who I'm really familiar with. Funny article this week. someone was on there. It was a Daily Caller. I don't know. They had a big article about former Jets GM Ryan Tannenbaum and his opinion on something. I thought that was funny. So anyway, you know, what the Jets did, it was the same thing. It was like, when you couldn't do anymore, what did you do? Well, we signed Mark Sanchez to an extension. What's the only other thing we can do? Oh, I know. We can trade for Tim Tebow. That'll work, right? It's like that was the mindset, because when you're someone that wants to make a splash, when you're someone that wants to take a risk, that's what you're going to do. And to punch yourself out of a salary cap hell when those risks don't work out, and most of the time they're not going to, you know, you just end up in a position that the Falcons are in right now, or the Jets were in 2013, or the Eagles are in right now. You know, it's like the Eagles right now. And they do some things that I think are fair. You know, they didn't go too crazy, but you look at some of these individual moves and you go, okay, well, makes sense. Then you think of them collectively, where the Eagles are as a franchise right now, does it really make sense for them to be signing Ryan Kerrigan for, I don't know, $3 million? In a sense, yeah, that gives you a high upside potential pass rusher, you know, if he can recapture his youth, and that's very cheap. You know, if he can do that. But are you the team that needs to be taking that risk? You know, do you need Anthony Harris to see if he can play at like a $10 million a year level again? You know, yeah, you've got to field the team. Yeah, you want to compete. I'm not advocating at all the strategy of just give up. But you also have to be realistic about certain things. And sometimes just because something looks like a good deal doesn't mean it's the right deal. And that's what happens with a lot of the guys who take a lot of risk. It's all well and good until it's not. And when it's not, it really goes off the rails because they only know one thing to do, for the most part. Not maybe in every situation, not everybody, I guess. But I think that's really what happened with Atlanta. It was like everything works to a point in time, and then things start to go south. And they just couldn't get over the hump, and they just started doing more dumb stuff. And that's what led to the problems that they have. You know, it's no different than what happened in New Orleans. Now, New Orleans is not as aggressive, I think, as Atlanta had been. New Orleans, obviously, is very aggressive, and they don't give two you-know-whats about the salary cap. You know, the Saints went 3 years going 7-9 with one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL. That's hard to do. That's really hard to do. The only reason they got out of it was because they had that one great draft class. But they had gone down a path of like no return. You know, it's very difficult to be, you know, as bad, I guess, as they were when you consider the talent at quarterback and some of the other positions on that team. So anyway, you know, I think that was just a general thought on how the Falcons got where they were. And it's just that you shouldn't be so set in kind of one strategy, one way to do stuff. You know, sometimes you do need to take a step back, and sometimes you do need to look, I think, at a little bit of a bigger picture. And maybe that requires also having a very difficult conversation with ownership about where the team is. And maybe it might end up costing you your job. So, you know, I get it, but you know, the odds are you're going to lose your job anyway, which is what happened with Atlanta. You know, and now you've left them in a much, much, much worse position. You know, so that was just on that. So the Danielle Hunter contract stuff came up again. And I have no idea where some of this stuff comes from. There was a report today. I don't remember from who. There was a report today that basically people from the Vikings, I guess, were claiming that at the time that was a great deal for him. And I have no idea where that comes from. So Hunter was 24 years old. He was going to be a free agent the next year at a position where teams typically go insane for players, especially young players. Typically go nuts for him, all right? He signs a contract that is 5 years, $72 million, $14.4 million a year. Only $17 million guaranteed at signing, with $40 million protected for injury. Those numbers at the time were not good numbers. I don't know where anyone thinks that was a good contract for him. I actually dug up an old Twitter post I had on it, just because people were saying, like, no, that was a good deal, that they were taking the Vikings side on that. And, you know, it's like, no, that wasn't a deal at all. That was a terrible deal. I'm just pulling up his page here. So you were looking at a young player. He's got 12 and a half sacks in 2016 as a kind of a reserve on the team. The next year, he starts 16 games, 7 sacks. Now, so he's being productive. And the important thing that you want to look at is his defensive playing time numbers. That's the thing. His numbers go from 37% as a rookie to 58% in his second year to 78% in 2017. When you cross that 70% threshold as an edge defender and you're a productive player, it means you are in line for big time money when you become a free agent. Because the thing is, there's only a handful of players that really go almost full time at that position. So it's a big savings for a team when they have a guy that can play that much. That means he can play the run, he can rush the passer, he can do whatever you're asking him to do. And that's a big deal because it means you don't have to spend the kind of money on backups that some of these other teams do, because even backup defensive ends are probably going to be in that anywhere from $3 to $7 million for a situational kind of pass rusher. You know, who's still decent. You know, not a guy like a reclamation project type player. So not surprisingly, in 2018, which is the year he signs the extension, he does make the Pro Bowl that year, 84% play time, because you knew where Minnesota was going with him. They just played him at 80%. Now, this was what got me back then. What the Vikings, I'm sure, did when they made this offer. At the time, I believe it, I'm just going to pull it up just to make sure I have the timeline right, but I believe Everson Griffin had recently signed a deal with them in 2017, an extension when he had 2 years remaining. Everson Griffin's deal was 4 years, $58 million, $14.5 per year, 18.8 full, 34 injury protected. How in the world does Griffin somehow block however much money Hunter is going to make? That never should have happened. There is in no way, shape, or form should that have been a comparable player to him. Griffin in 2017 was 30 years old. When his extension kicked in, he was 32. You know, when the extension years kicked in, he would have been 32, and he only played one extension year. All right, they couldn't, you know, they needed to get rid of him. You know, it didn't work out with that at all. If you're 24, your comparable is not a 30-year-old. I don't care if he's on the same team. I don't care if he plays the same position. That is not your comparable at all, unless that guy is making such a huge amount of money that, you know, you can come up with the thought process of, all right, he's making 20, we'll pay you 19.9. It was nowhere in that ballpark. The market for players like Hunter that could rush the passer and play that amount of snaps was about $18 million a year. It wasn't $14 million. It wasn't that he couldn't be the highest paid pass rusher on his team. If you're Minnesota, do not tell me that was a good deal for him at the time. Not even close. You know, I'm just looking, you know, Griffin at the time was basically the same thing, you know, 80% player. You know, you look at his numbers. Yeah, it was a pro. He had Pro Bowls, but he had Pro Bowls because at that point he had set himself up as a name value from how he had played before. There was no reason for the two to be lumped together. None at all. You know, if we look, let me just see if I can pull up some of the stuff. But the main comparables then were players like Vernon. You know, Chandler Jones, who had signed a few years before. And you can argue that, okay, he's not a first-round pick. You know, he wasn't as highly touted as those players. Well, Vernon wasn't either, but, you know, Vernon got to free agency. But, you know, there's just no logic behind why he would take a deal at 14. Besides, you know, the other part of the comment was, hey, would you turn down $72 million? And the answer is no. You probably, you know, when you think about it from that respect, no. And that's the leverage that a lot of these teams have sometimes over the players, is that it is a ton of money you're talking about. And at that point where it's just like, all right, I think you should get an extra $4 million a year. That's a hell of a lot of money, but it's also a lot of money just to get in your pocket right then and there. Let me just take a look at the edge position here. Edge position in 2017, 2018, I guess. I'm just looking at some extensions that were here. Yeah, so I mean, Hunter, Quinn in 2014 signed for 14.2. And this was 4 years later. 10.4, Junior Gallette, remember him? Ryan Kerrigan was at 11.5, signed 3 years earlier. You inflate these things, you know, they're, you know, big numbers. And then when you start looking at the free agents, I mean, he was nowhere near where he should have been. And it's one of the few contracts that have been signed. There's two that I can recall. There's probably, there is a third too. So the most feedback that I ever got on contract signings, texts from people who work in the, either in the league or as agents or whatever. So around the league, Patrick Mahomes, that was like a what in the world is going on kind of thing. Like nobody could believe those numbers when they came in, because they thought they were way insane. For Mahomes, not for the Chiefs. CJ Mosley was another one I got a lot of, like, what are they paying that much money for a linebacker for? But not even as crazy. And the other one was this Hunter deal. It was like, why are they doing this? Why they just screwed over the edge rusher market was basically the thought process of it, because of what they took there. So that is complete BS that he was only worth that then. And now he's magically worth a lot more money. So, it's like, yeah, is he worth more? Sure. But he signed the deal. And it was complete buyer's remorse by the next year. He signs that deal in 2018, right? By the next year, his money is being passed by linebackers. That he's earning less than someone like maybe less than a Quan Alexander, certainly less than CJ Mosley, maybe Deion Jones. That was the year he was supposed to be a free agent. He was supposed to get that kind of money. Quan Alexander was 13.5. And so how do you look at that and be happy with it? Now, a lot of people, it was like the same thing with the Smith deal. In Dallas, their left tackle, Tyron Smith, where, the comment is, well, he's very happy in Minnesota. He's happy to take a discount, yada, yada, yada. Yeah, you're happy about that stuff for like a year. You're happy about it for a period of time, but then you get unhappy. One of the difficult things with contracts, and I think this is one of the reasons why we don't see so many or as many quote unquote great contracts for a team. You do see some bad ones. But I think one of the reasons why you don't see as many great contracts for a team is one of the things when you're negotiating a deal and you're looking to, especially when you're looking to keep a player, you are looking at something as a long-term investment, right? Well, one of the things you want is you want your long-term investment to be happy. So if you sign someone to a below-market contract, what happens is they get unhappy pretty quick. And if you hold the feet to the fire sometimes, it can really blow up on you. Now, there does come a point in time where you do have to do that. The biggest situation, the most notable situation where somebody got a deal. Now, I wouldn't say that it was a deal that was unfair at the time. If anything, it was actually very bullish at the time, was when the Steelers did the deal with Antonio Brown. And the Steelers didn't touch that for years. They were willing to tinker a little bit, but they wouldn't extend him. But one of the things is, if you get too good of a deal, if you hammer the player over the head, pretty quick it's going to come out that they didn't take a good deal. Pretty quick, they're going to see the guys around them get paid a lot more money and they're not as good of a player. Pretty soon they're going to look and they're going to hear from other players about what they did because their agents are going to look to poach them. We can do better for you. We can get it fixed. That's a bunch of BS most of the time, but you're going to hear about it. Eventually, the bigger reporters pick up on it and start to say, yeah, he's really, really, really underpaid. So it's like you could have seen this coming from a mile away. This almost seemed this deal, and I think I remember talking about it at the time. This deal felt like a contract that was an initial offer that was just to kind of get the ball rolling, and that they just were like, okay, yeah, we'll accept it. Now, obviously, that's not what happened. All right, but that was the way that this felt, all right? This had that feeling of something like that. And regardless of whether or not that's how it happened, they were creating a situation where the player was not going to be happy down the line, at least in my opinion. So now you look at his deal, though, you know, and here's the other thing that comes into play. It's like, what leverage does he have? He missed all of last season, and he's got 3 years remaining on his deal. So, yes, is he underpaid? Yeah, he was underpaid when he signed the deal. He still signed the deal. As an organization, you also have to have certain things in place, you know, that are consistent. You know, where I talked about the Steelers. The Steelers were consistent. We are not doing deals. We're not doing new contracts unless you have 1 year under contract. They did some agreements with Antonio Brown, but maybe this is a way that you can pacify the situation. You move a couple dollars up. It's like, okay, you know what? Yeah, we envision you being here in 2022. So we'll take $3 million of your salary from 2022 and we'll move it into 2021. How do you like that? Now, I'm not, I didn't even look at their cap space to see if they could do that. Let's take a quick look, see if they can pump up an extra 3 to 5. They can throw them a couple dollars, probably $3 million. They could throw them. Not extra, just moving it from 1 year to the other. So, you know, that might be something they can do. But if you tear up a contract with 3 years remaining, you have no leg to stand on when you deal with other teams. Now, the Vikings have already shown a very clear precedence when it comes to contract renegotiations. They're willing to do it with 2 years left on the deal. We saw that with Adam Thielen. We saw it with Everson Griffin. We saw it with Linval Joseph. They are willing to do the deals with 2 years left. I'm not crazy about that philosophy. In the Thielen case, it was probably a necessity. That was another one where they hit the hammer over the head when they did that deal. You can't do it with 3 years, especially for a guy who was hurt. Like, what message does that send to the rest of your roster? Trust me, it's not a good one. You might be listening and say, no, it shows that they care about their players. No, it's not going to show that at all. It's going to show that they can get bullied by their players. That's what that's going to show. I don't care what you want to say about what happened with Diggs, you know, when that they shipped him out. It's going to show that, you know, that they're willing to play ball financially with you at a much earlier date. So I'm not saying that they won't do it, that they won't go and extend him, because I don't know what they're doing in Minnesota right now. This is one of the best, I thought, with the contract stuff. They haven't been bad at the contract stuff. It's just that they're just at times that there's things that they're doing where you're just like, man, they're kind of lost. But it doesn't make any sense for them to redo it. And I think it just sets such a bad precedent that's going to come back and bite them 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 4 years from now, all the time it's going to come back and do that. So I think that they have to stay away from that at all costs, and they really have to hold firm here. They have to absolutely 100% hold firm on this contract remaining in place, with the exception of, you know, if you want to throw him an extra couple bucks or you want to guarantee his salary for the year, which doesn't mean a thing, you know, you go ahead and do it. You know, that's fine. You can do that, but you can't tear it up and give him a new contract because it's the quote unquote right thing to do. It's not going to be good for your team if you do something like that. It's just, you're talking about too much money. You're talking about way too much risk given the injuries last year. You absolutely can't do it. So I think Minnesota has to just let this play out. If Hunter wants to go, and they can find a trade partner for him, you know, you can do a June 1 here. They'd create a lot of cap space. I'm not saying it makes the team any better, because it doesn't. But if you're looking at it from that perspective, you know, that there could be a logical reason, I guess, for doing it. You know, they're kind of in a sort of semi-rebuilding state, even though they have Kirk Cousins. You know, they're kind of they're just in a weird place. You know, but if they want to do that, you know, they'll defer 7 dead to next year, and they'll keep 5 in this year. So they'll save themselves this $12.75 million salary by trading him out. I don't think that's out of the realm of possibilities, because what we saw with Diggs, I think, is they got to a point where they were just like, don't want to deal with a headache. So maybe if Hunter becomes enough of a headache, they would move on. But I just don't see any extending him is not the solution at all. If they extend him, we will be sitting here next February, I almost guarantee it, with people complaining about the fact that they can't move on from Hunter next season. That's probably what will happen. You know, if they actually go and extend him, that's probably what will happen. That is such an interesting division, I tell you. You know, between the Packers with a quarterback who desperately wants out. And, you know, and here's one. This was a the Florio article, I think it was this week. Maybe it was last week. And it was one of those, the NFL really has to deal with the players having so much power now. Who has been traded this year that has whined that they have wanted out? Last time I looked, Russell Wilson was a Seahawk. Aaron Rodgers still a Packer. Who are all these players who have demanded new starts that are no longer on their teams? Julio Jones? Maybe he'll be traded? They were looking to get rid of him before. And that wasn't him wanting out. That was them looking to see what they could get for him because he's one of the few guys they can move on from. Has Deshaun Watson been traded? I mean, they have a lot of quarterbacks there, but he's still in Houston. They might not acknowledge him by name, but he's still there. Players still have no leverage. The contracts have not been designed to really gain leverage to demand an out. Yes, you can get noisy, and yeah, you can get to a point where you can maybe make enough noise to where they'll get rid of you. You know, you become such a problem, you become Antonio Brown. Yeah, you bark your way out of a team. You know, like I can only imagine how much fun Terrell Owens would be with the social media stuff. Like he'd be a blast. But that's basically what happens. You know, it just becomes another. It's just another little bit of a nuisance that teams have to learn to deal with. But it doesn't mean anything. Nobody's getting shipped anywhere. Nobody is doing all these threats and moving. It's no different than it was before. It's no different than with the Terrell Owens or Brett Favre or any of those guys making a scene, more or less towards the end of their careers. Owens was younger. You know, it's not. I don't know where that stuff comes from at all, but it is an interesting division. You know, it's wide open. You know, when you look at that, and right now, you know, the team really that's done the best, I think, in terms of looking toward, I think, the future is probably Chicago at this point. Now, that doesn't mean Chicago's in a good spot, but, you know, they made the best that they could to be able to get the quarterback they did. So I think that's kind of, I don't know, that's kind of intriguing there to see how they can do with it. I kind of like the way they've approached quarterback really over the last 2 years. Just from a standpoint, I think, of just philosophy, I think, for what they did. I think it's actually pretty good. But they right now, they need that rookie quarterback to salvage their salary cap issues, which are not very good. And that's the one negative for them. You know, that they're not going to get a benefit from that. And I guess I may as well just segue that into, you know, this other thing. So just if you go on OTC, if you haven't checked it out, I wrote a little article this week. I think it was last Sunday, actually. So last weekend, where, you know, looking at free agency in the draft. And this was just to put some numbers on some things where sometimes we talk about different stuff. And for this one, it was basically looking at what the pure salary cap benefit is for top players. You know, you think you're getting a top player first round, second round, maybe sometimes third round. So basically what I did was I took the salary of the 10th highest paid player at a position, because that's your goal, right? To get a top 10 player out of your draft pick, and compared that with the average contract for a first round draft pick. Now, obviously these numbers vary depending on where you pick. You know, the benefit could be more or less, but what you see here, when you look at this, you know, a quarterback, you know, it's huge. It gives you, $26 million in benefit. So basically, if you have a quarterback on a rookie contract, that means you have $26 million a year more to spend elsewhere on your team than if you had a good veteran quarterback. So obviously, you know, you that's a great position. So you throw quarterback out, though, because quarterback is kind of wild. So when you look at these other positions, all right, what are the next ones that come up here? I'm not actually sure how I sorted these. I have no idea what I did. Oh, I know. I see where. I put these adjustments in there. I'll talk about that in a minute. But you look at left tackle, that $11 million benefit. Wide receiver, $13.5 million. Edge rusher, $13.4 million. Interior defenders, 9.6. Cornerbacks, 9.8. It's like these are your positions you should be focusing on, because now what you're doing is you're creating big amounts of space that you can use to fill other positions. And the interesting thing that I wanted to look at here was when you looked at these other positions, when you looked at all the positions, well, if you don't draft them, can you get them in free agency? Because that's your other avenue, right? Yeah, we trade a little bit in the NFL, but basically we have two ways to build our team, draft, free agency. That's two spots where we find them. And when you look at these things, I looked at the availability of players in terms of contract value, again, that were signed in free agency or could have been signed in free agency. You know, occasionally you'll have a guy that re-ups with a team in March. I always count those players as free agents because just because they technically signed an extension before the expiration of their contract, they were set to be a free agent. They knew they had the rights to go and, negotiate with other teams. You look at these players, and now this is very different. So quarterbacks, 25% are found in free agency. Now, remember, of that 25%, most of those players are near the bottom of the top 20. So who are we talking about? Fitzpatrick, Nick Foles. So we're talking about lower echelon players, Andy Dalton. That's the type of players that we're looking at that were signed in free agency. Left tackle, only 20%. It's the lowest in the league. So it's not a position that's available in free agency. So while we can argue about the impact of the left tackle versus the right tackle, or the impact overall that a left tackle has on the team, like that there's only so much you can get out of a left tackle, right? That the best left tackle in the world is not going to make up for the fact that you've got a bad quarterback. No matter how much you can protect him, it doesn't really make a difference. The fact is you can't find them in free agency, the players who are good. So you're almost locked in on the draft. You look at wide receiver, 30% available. So again, your top players don't leave teams. Pass rusher, about 45%. Interior defensive line, about 40%. Interesting one was corner. Now, I knew a lot of corners are available. We've talked about this before. And obviously, you need to fill a lot of voids at corner. 70% of the top 20 players are signed in free agency. So while their peak years probably do occur when they're a rookie, you have access to a lot of top talent. So that actually devalues them a little bit as a draft pick, only because it is a position that you can go and buy. Guard surprised me, only 45% available. I thought it would have been higher than that. I thought it would have been more than 50. But, you know, usually I guess what happens is you get one or two high-paying guards that leave, and then a lot of the other guys end up staying. So I guess there's a bigger range. Then you get into some of these other positions, linebacker, safety, 60%, center, 55, right tackle, 55, tight end, 55. Those are positions where it's more likely, you know, you're going to find those good players in free agency. Running back was 45% as well, but that's an oddball one because a lot of running backs just simply don't get a second contract. That's a little different than these other positions. So yeah, I thought that was just kind of a little fascinating thing. And when you put those numbers on there and you just look at the two benefits that you can get, which is all this money that you can have to spend on free agents, and what how hard it is to sign the player in free agency, you can come up. I came up with adjustments that you could throw on a draft grade. Again, you're only looking at the first couple of rounds of the draft because the end rounds, the hit rates are so low. You can't look at it as like getting a top 10 player. And you can adjust these for where you pick and everything else. This is just rough. This is just a rough run with it. But I thought it makes a little bit of intuitive sense that a quarterback, you should bump their grade by like 130%. Left tackle, 77%. Wide receivers, 52%. Edge rushers, 25%. Defensive line, 10%. And you should drop your corner grades by about 13%. Drop your guards by 14%. Linebackers, 22%. Safeties, 24%. Centers, 26%. Right tackles, 34%. Running backs, 35%. And tight ends, 38%. And it's just to help you, you know, with tiebreakers a little bit, because we talk so much about best available player, best available player, best available player. Oh, I hated that with McCagnan. And then the other thing that we look at sometimes is need, you know, and that's the other philosophy. And I don't think either is necessarily right, because what you're trying to do is, again, how can we build our team? You're basically building your team primarily through the draft, free agency, and then you fill in with your roster claims, your practice squad, you know, your development of undrafted players, your development of players that you pull off the street from other organizations. But, you know, you need to maximize those two main ways that you can build your team. And like I said earlier, your eyes can't only be on this season. If your eyes are only on this season, that's where you fall into the draft for need category. You're drafting to fill something that you're really only going to impact the short term, that you need in the short term. Players probably aren't ready to play in the short term. You know, it's free agents are ready to give you short term. Draft picks are probably going to be a 1 year delay before you hit that kind of peak performance. You know, there's exceptions to that, obviously. But when you're looking at building a team and you're looking at a 2 or 3 year period, all right, you have to look at what are the positions that you can buy and you can improve via free agency, and what are the positions that you want to improve most in the draft. And I think this is where you get into these things where let's say that you have a wide receiver and a cornerback that have an equivalent grade, you know, or let's say the corner is a little bit higher. You have to ask yourself now, okay, what makes more sense for us? We know we need these two positions. And we know it'll be a need in the next 2 years, no matter what. So we know we need them. And we want to pick one of these guys. So the way that I would probably look at something like this is I would think first, okay, what if we draft the cornerback? Now we've got to go into free agency and get us a wide receiver. So I'll just throw two players out there. Just, you know, let's say we did so well, we drafted Jalen Ramsey. And my next question now is, okay, am I better off with Jalen Ramsey and I've got about $9.8 million in a cap benefit of sorts? So with that money, I can probably buy maybe a player like a Jamison Crowder. All right, that's about as high as I can punch for the most part. You know, decent player, nice player. So that's one option. My second option, I can draft a wide receiver. Let's say for the sake of argument, it's like Amari Cooper or Michael Thomas, or, you know, Michael Thomas better than Amari Cooper, but, you know, someone like that. And I've gained $13.56 million in salary cap, you know, on something like that. Well, now what can I do? Well, now I look at corner. Well, I need to buy a corner. Who can I buy for $13.6 million at cornerback? Let's take a quick look. Let's see who would be, just if we wanted to spend $13.6 million, just our benefit. And so I would look at that and I'd say, okay, $13.6 million. All right, that gets me a player like a William Jackson. That gets me, oh man, doesn't get me, well, Trey Waynes. Yeah, that's a bad one. That just was bad signing. You know, so that's one option, and that's just with those numbers. Now, here's the other one. I go, okay, but let's just say I want to get a great. So I draft Jalen Ramsey, and I want to get a great wide receiver. So I go and I look at wide receiver, and I take a look, and I go, who's been available in free agency? No. Mari Cooper, he was available. That would have cost me 20. Then it's a no and no and no. Galladay. He would have cost me 18. So basically I would have my corner, and then I would have to spend 18 to 20 million on a receiver and hope that I could get that receiver. You know, these guys are hardly available. You look at the top receivers, extension, free agent, extension, free agent, franchise, extension. The only reason that the numbers were actually as high as they were on the unrestricted numbers when I said free agents available, because I considered players like a Robert Woods, who were not top 20 receivers when they were signed, free agents, because they were acquired via free agency. So you did acquire a good player. You just didn't know. Well, maybe you did know he was going to be that good, but there was nothing that had shown he was going to be that good. Now, the other option is, let's say we drafted this Amari Cooper type. Now we go to corner, and now we look at, again, we want to punch up. Who can we get? Well, if we want to go to $16 million, we've got Byron Jones. 14.5 was Bradbury. Waynes was 14. William Jackson was 13.5. We could do Griffin at 13.3. Adoree Jackson, that's a bad deal, but 13. Gilmore was 13. Joe Hayden was available in free agency years ago. Roby's 10.5. So the point is, you got a ton of options here, and you're going to be able to sign one of them probably because there's so many available. So I think when you start to look at that, and that's what you have to do. You know, when you build your rosters out, you know, I think the important thing to do is you have to plot out all these different outcomes. How you get to those outcomes, you know, with the war metric, grades, I don't know. I'm not exactly sure how you do that. All right. What you would use to determine it, other than just hope that they play up to a certain contract level. You know, and you could, you know, do that. You know, what are the odds they play up to a $20 million? And you have ways that you could estimate that based on some typical statistics. Whether that counts towards wins or not, I don't really know right now. But basically, you want to put together these series of outcomes, and you know, you talk about the risk and the rewards and all these things. You just want to look to see how far that you can be pushed. When you start getting into things about not just singular events, like, well, draft a corner because he's best available player, or we drafted Leonard Williams because we had the top grade on him. You're getting into these things with what should be a different approach, because what you should be looking at is, okay, if I draft this position, where does this impact me at five other spots? You know, where if I sign this free agent, you know, where does it leave me? What is my roster going to be when I'm the Atlanta Falcons and I draft a tight end at number four? Where does that leave me with building up the rest of my roster? You know, if I've used a pick at number four at tight end, well, where am I going to go and find, you know, another wide receiver? Now, in their case, they have one with Calvin Ridley. Okay. You know, where am I going to find a left tackle? Maybe they look at, you know, their left tackle is, he's a little bit, I guess a little bit older, but certainly should have plenty of time left. So they probably look at that as okay. And now you start looking at some of the other positions. You know, it's like, well, what about quarterback? Matt Ryan's probably going to give you another year, maybe two, you know, probably 2 years. You know, okay, maybe you should have thought about a quarterback. Okay. You know, what about some of these other spots? You know, what are you looking at? What are you doing with your pass rushers? What's your pass rush? Where is it? Now, was there a pass rusher that was drafted high this year? I don't even recall. I don't think so. It was not wasn't considered a great draft for defense, I guess. But, you know, those are the questions that you have to ask yourself. And you have to take this, like, big overall view, I think, of the teams when you kind of construct your strategies. And I think many of the teams don't do it. I think a lot of times it's almost like as if they're binary things. Like, you know, I don't think sometimes the full picture is taken into account. With certain teams, it certainly is. But I think with a lot of teams, it's not. And it's almost just like you're just trading the merits off with, you know, why do I love this guy? Why do I love this guy? Why do I love this one? Why do I love this one? Rather than looking at, okay, well, if I love this guy and I love this one a little bit less, but can he get me a whole bunch of other guys that I'm going to love a lot more in free agency? And the answer might be yes. And sometimes I think that's what you really need to do. Most of the time, that's probably what you should do. All right, so let me get into questions here. If Julio Jones were a free agent now, what kind of contract would he be looking at? Would he get his current $37 million over three? Yeah, absolutely. Jones is only coming off one down year, so he absolutely would. I don't think there is any hesitation in my mind that he would get at least that amount of money on the open market. How much would be guaranteed? That I'm not sure of, but I do think that he would get a lot of interest if he was a free agent. But yeah, I absolutely think that he would probably get that on the open market. I think the name value would be enough for that. There was on the Jones front, there was a rumor that a team offered a future first round pick. Now they're trying to claim that it's a 2022 pick. I don't believe that for a second. I don't think any team is going to trade a 2022 number one unless it's highly conditional. There's just too much risk involved with doing that kind of thing. All right, let's take a look here. Which teams spend the highest percentage of their salary cap on the defense? Okay, so you can look that up if you wanted to. If we're looking at cap space on positional spending, so that should be under the trends. So if you go to trends and then you click down, there should be a positional spending link. That'll give you how much teams are spending. So let me just pull it up. And on defense right now, the Patriots are number one. They have $117 million on the cap with that. Now, these numbers are, I think, the full roster. But they have 117. The Chiefs are at 107. The Bills are at 105. Broncos, 104. Football team, 102. Cardinals, 101. And the Bears at $99 million. So those are the teams that have super heavy investment on the cap at the moment on, on defense. And offensively, even though you didn't ask that, the Browns are number one at 141. Robert says, what percentage of players across the league are attending voluntary workouts? And given the union's view on this, does this create an issue between the union and its membership? I don't think that there's going to be an issue between the union and their membership. I don't think that this is going to be an issue. I think there might already be an issue with that. I don't think this really changes too much in regards to that. I don't know how many players are attending. From the sounds of it, for certain teams, it's a lot. For other teams, not so many. If I had to put a league-wide number on it, I'd guess maybe 60%. I don't think it's I think it's overblown the amount of players who probably did not show up. I think that there were certain teams early on. I think now that it's gotten later on in the process, I think more and more players are going. I think if you have money tied to it, they're attending. So, I think there's enough players are going. I don't think it's turning into a giant boycott. I think it's basically a certain veterans not showing up kind of deal. Versus like a league-wide kind of thing. I think the league thing kind of blew over pretty quick. Again, remember that initial selling point on it was COVID. The COVID stuff was pretty much not a concern by the time workouts really even began. You saw some teams negotiate with the players to basically say, look, the Dolphins said you can walk around in flip-flops. Players, that teams just want to have you close. They just want to be working with you. They don't care about they don't care as much about the other stuff. They really don't. Black Gold, Alex Lewis's pay cut to about $4 million cap plus Dan Feeney at $4 million and Greg Van Roten at $4 million. How does that compare to getting one $12 million player? What are your thoughts on JD letting Lewis go to the NFI list to still get paid with the hopes of this pay cut? There's a couple of ways that you can look at this for the Jets. I mean, if you got one player at $12 million, if you signed a guard, you would probably be set at the position. You know, the guard busting is not nearly as much as some of the other positions. Usually it's a much steadier option in free agency. If you could have found somebody, I don't know if you would have been able to, in this year in particular, there really weren't, players. I'm just looking to see if anyone signed this year. Now Irving was five. Seeing if there's anybody else that signed this year. Gabe Jackson was a trade. Zeitler's at 7-5. So there really weren't a lot of other options. So I can't say that they had another option, but in theoretical, you're probably better off with one player at 12, given that you know that the player is probably going to be decent, versus three players at 12. Now, if your option is one player at 4, or say two players at 7 versus three at 12, I don't know how important it is for them to really have a great play here. Probably going with the numbers in this case, you know, it probably does make sense. You're looking to find your best available option. The only thing is, if you're willing to do that, you have to be willing to deal with the consequence that you might have a rotation at guard at some point, meaning you're not going to be one of those teams that simply has a group of players and you end up saying, all right, you know, this is our offensive line. We want to have our same starting five every week, every game. You know, that you have to be willing, if whomever wins the job in training camp flops, like during the year, you have to be willing to pull the plug even if they're not hurt. You know, that's why you have these other players to do that. So I think that's probably what the Jets were thinking by keeping him. Now, he's only guaranteed $1 million, so it's not like they can't cut him. They could still cut him if they wanted to. It's only $1 million. So it's not really that much of a risk, I think, for them. I don't think they gave up much to do it. So I think it's okay to do. I think it's a fair one for them. I hope Feeney wins only because he's got the great hair game. So, you know, that would be nice. But, you know, I think that's okay. I don't know. I didn't read this anywhere. Second part of this is, what are your thoughts on Joe Douglas letting Lewis go to the NFI list to still get paid with the hopes of this pay cut? I didn't follow that. So I don't know if he said that or not. The whole situation was kind of odd with him last year, but maybe that was at the back of his mind that, you know, that they would, if they did a, you know, treated him fairly last year as he went through his stuff, that, you know, they would be able to go to him and say, look, we want to try to keep you this year, but it needs to be cheaper. So maybe that was a little bit of a thought, but I don't know. Pete says, any idea how many practice squad members will be carried per team? Last year, the number was supposed to rise, but with COVID, they bumped it up even more. I to be honest, I'm not even sure off top of my head. I don't remember what that number was. 12 supposed to be. I don't recall what they are. The more practice squad players, the more work it is for me. Just because it's more players, I got to move up and down since there's usually a lot of practice squad movement, but I don't know. That's okay. It's not the end of the world. Let's see. The Cowboys 2022 cap. What about it? I'm sure it's bad. Probably third or fourth worst in the league because of Dak. Cowboys 2022. Oh, yeah. Second worst in the league. About 20 over. You know, it's one of those. They're going to have to make a decision probably on Amari Cooper. Depends on how he plays with Prescott and how the other guys are doing. You know, you're stuck with Zeke. You can probably get rid of Jalen Smith. You know, that'll give you a couple million, $5 million. Tackles are going to stay. You know, Collins would be the one that you're probably a little bit more worried about how he's going to do. You know, basically, you're just going to be restructuring Dak's contract, and you're probably going to have to make a longer term decision if you want to keep going with DeMarcus Lawrence, like how much longer, because you're probably at the point, you know, his cap number is 27, 19 to cut. And I think he's only got 2 years left. Yeah. You would have the 2022, 2023 season. So I think almost because of the cap considerations, you might want to consider extending him. They probably just have to think about it. You know, if the belief is, and Jerry would know this probably better than most, if the belief really is that the 2023 cap might spike way more than, you know, I'm even saying there with a $14-15 million a year growth, or 14-15% growth, you know, he may see reasons to just defer money to 2023 by doing another restructure, adding more void years. So, I mean, that's a possibility as well. But Dallas doesn't really operate in free agency, so I usually don't get too worried about their cap, only because they don't really use it for other stuff. You know, their cap is mainly a concern for maintaining their current roster, not so much adding to it. All right, let's see here. Vice says, what does a consult with a team look like? What kinds of questions are asked? I know you can't get into specifics. Thanks, love the pod on the site. So, you know, typically with the consulting stuff, it's more just like getting second opinions on things. Occasionally it's working with a couple numbers things when it comes to projections and stuff and benchmarking what, you know, a lot of it's benchmarking what other teams are doing. What are some, you know, some the players coming up in free agency, just to, what's an opinion? What do you think? You know, what do you think of this guy? What do you think of that guy? General market stuff, that's there, you know, where's the market moving? How many players are available? You know, the availability of players a lot of times is a big thing, because a lot of times availability determines salary. So, you know, for example, this year, when you look at guard and you look at Tooney, he was the only guy available. In a normal year, I think if he would have had like three guards available, he wouldn't have made nearly as much money. But you have to be aware sometimes of what the market is and aware of how hot the bidding might actually get for players. So, you know, those are the kind of things. But more of the stuff that I do is really on the agent side. It's more on the player side. And those really detail more breaking down either an entire position, both for free agency and just general trends. And then the other stuff is getting heavy in on a specific player where you're kind of going with – finding market comparables, finding market trends, trying to identify teams that might have a need, trying to identify teams that also have money to spend and have money to spend at that position. You know, like you look at the spending that you might have. You know, we talk about cornerback, right? Most teams carry three corners who are going to be involved a lot. You carry a lot more than three corners, but what's the average that teams spend on their top three players? What's the average they spend on their top two? Who are the players that are already invested in that top two? Because you can just throw those teams out. You know, don't, if they come to you, they're probably not coming to you looking to pay a lot of money. They're probably coming to you to try to lowball. So it's little things like that that we kind of do. Joe says, if the Broncos were to try and extend Cortland Sutton right now, what would a fair deal look like? I haven't given that any thought. Yeah, so he's coming off an injured year. He was at, I'm just pulling up his numbers here, 704 as a rookie, 1100 his second year, 10 total touchdowns. I would guess even coming off an injury, you know, he would be looking to get at least, you know, where was Allen Robinson after his injury? 14, 15 a year? You know, I would think it would be in that range. Where was Robinson? Robinson, when he signed with the Bears, signed for $14 million a year. So, yeah, I would guess all things considered, you know, 15, 16. I don't think, you know, the wide receivers are valuable. So, I don't think it would benefit them to extend him. You know, unless he was willing to really come for cheap, I don't think there would be a benefit to that. I think they're better off just, you know, holding out. Let's see. Recently, you discussed trading up and some misconceptions around it. One argument you didn't address was when a contending team gives up a lot and trades up. Is it warranted either to limit the cap hit of rookies or because they don't have many roster spots open? So again, I guess it depends on the situation as to, you know, what they're doing. I think if you're a really good team and you're trading up, it probably doesn't, I don't think it makes a lot of sense unless you're filling a need that is something that you absolutely know is a need for, you know, the next couple of years. Because again, where we talk about these things, you know, the concept of the drafting for need in the draft. If you are trading up because you think that's going to put you over the top, it's pretty rare that the rookie comes in as a rookie and has that kind of year that you just get put over the top. You know, occasionally, again, you know, it happens. But I think if you're trading up for someone, you're trading up not so much because of an immediate need. You're trading up because you have a 4-year need or a 3-year need. And you see this guy as like a elite level transformative player that you're doing that with. So I think the trade up, I actually wouldn't do that as much if I'm a good football team. Now there's exceptions. You know, if you're getting a quarterback, yeah, that's an exception. You know, even, you know, I'll even say this, while I'm never going to advocate for drafting a running back, but that's a position that probably is an immediate fill. Maybe even a linebacker, that maybe could be an immediate contributing fill. So for some reason, if that was the position you were jumping up for, you know, let's say you were jumping up to the, you know, late first round for something or higher in the second round, I can at least understand that a little bit, because you think it's someone that's going to contribute right away. But most of the players, you know, I don't think they, I just don't think that's the case, you know, when you do it. You know, the way to do it, you know, if you're concerned about roster spots, which is legitimate, you know, you could have that theory like, we've got a lot of guys, you know, we don't need to be paying another $4 million to a rookie or whatever. Seattle, that's one of the reasons why Seattle, I think, drops out of the first round so much and they drop back. I think they look at it as that the cost of the second round is much lower. You know, it's like a 20% drop or something from 32 to 33. So you're better off doing that, you know, dropping out of the first round sometimes. And, you know, I think the other thing that you have to take a look at with it is the New England Patriots style. What the Patriots used to do, and I thought it was very smart, is a lot of times you would see them trade out, meaning they just look to get future picks. And the future picks would be more useful when they, you know, needed them. And so I think that that is actually a more viable solution if you don't feel like you have the need for players on your team. And every team really has a need for players. But I think the right move in those spots is to pick up stuff the following year. Here's another comment about AVT. I'm just going to be done talking about that one. Miguel says, how many 2020 opt-outs are still on their 2019 team? Let me see if I can pull that up real quick. Let's take a look. Let me pause this for a minute because I got to do a little search on that. So just give me a minute here. Okay. Now it's entirely possible because of some little minor things in the way that we track the players. There could be one or two guys that I'm missing here. So hopefully I did this right. in running my search. So there's a chance that this number could be off a little bit because I thought there were a couple more opt-outs than this. It looks like I'm seeing 67 opt-outs, I think. Let me just take a quick look here on my list. I think I'm seeing 67. I thought there might have been more, but maybe not. So based on that, there are 24 players who are no longer in the league. Right now, or at least I don't have contract information for them, but I right now I just don't think that they're in the league unless they signed in the last couple of days. 39 players are still on the same team, and 4 players switch teams. The 4 players who have switched teams are Marcus Cannon, Damian Williams, Al Woods, and Rashawn Melvin. The players out of the league: Josh Harvey Clemens, Jamize Olawale, Eddie Vanderdus, Jason Vanderland, Damari Scott, Kyle Pico, Russell Bodine, Cole Wick. I don't know. There's a bunch of guys here that I don't think there's any point in reading through all these players not here. You know, so the Chance Warmack, I mean, he's a name player at least. So those are the players I have that are no longer in the league. So there might be one or two other guys that are hanging around, but basically most of the guys, you know, it's basically a split. Either you're just not in football right now or you're probably still on the same team. Let me take a look here. Ted says, how easily can the Cowboys get under the cap next year with restructuring Dak's contract and maybe a few cuts? So I think if they restructure it, I mean, they'll be able to get under the cap. They're not going to be far under. You know, it's maybe next week. Maybe I'll try to look at the Cowboys a little bit more since I got a couple questions on them here. But I would say that you know, that would just be my rough guess on it, is that they will probably be able to not have a difficult time getting under it, but they won't be getting far under it, if that makes any sense. So I think that's everything. I think that's everything that's here. Let me just, I'm just looking through. I'm almost positive I got nothing on my email. Let me just take one more look. Nope. I think that is it for me. So, yep. So that is everything for me. So I will be back again next week, hopefully, and we'll do some other discussions. So if you have any questions, send them over. In the meantime, everyone have a great Memorial Day. Have a great week. And I will talk to you all again soon.